ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's just your average suburb, but there's a whiff of someone playing silly duckers. Reg Grundy's kids' clothes and stuffed toys are going missing.
This is Leonardo da Vinci.
Hi, I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and I've secured an interview with Leonardo da Vinci, the criminal cat, thieving mastermind, for my podcast series, Nature's Most Wanted.
What the duck?
On ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Belinda Smith with The Science Show, and we have a treat for you. A taste of the most exciting research from across the world, presented at the Falling Walls Science Summit in Berlin. This event is focused on finding scientific breakthroughs as momentous for society as the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Carl Smith, now a resident of Berlin, caught up with researchers representing Australia at Falling Walls late last year.
From reef restoration using sound, to skeletal editing, to bespoke satellites for emergency services, and to genetic band-aids, the Falling Walls Science Summit in Berlin brings together some of the world's leading voices in science to present a smorgasbord of the cutting edge of innovation.
I guess Falling Walls has a real interesting vibe to it. It's here in Berlin. It's on, this time, the 36th anniversary of the walls coming down, and it is very much focused on how do we make progress. It is definitively a German event that has a whole bunch of really interesting people from around the world. So for me, I'm meeting a bunch of people I know, but that I don't get to see very often. And I get to catch up and have conversations about what's interesting to them. But it's ultimately the quality of the people. So there's, you know, they really screen. We have contests in Australia to decide who from Australia gets to come here and present. So you get a really good quality group of people.
Australian Nobel laureate and former Vice Chancellor of the Australian National University, distinguished Professor Brian Schmidt, says it's vital for Australians to be at events like this on the global stage.
So you really get to see what's going on in the world here. And when we live in Australia, which is a long ways away from everywhere, it's very easy to get disconnected. So I can tell Australian stories here so they know what we're doing. Because in the end, research is about creating knowledge, and knowledge is sharing and raising all boats and hopefully making the world a better place.
Looking across the 2025 schedule, there are plenty representing our region, including the winner of the Falling Walls Lab Australia competition, Mabel Day, who is competing against other regional winners with a short talk on her research.
I'm Mabel Day from the University of Adelaide, and I'm doing my PhD in chemistry.
And why are you here at Falling Walls?
I'm here to represent Australia and present my research on PFAS degradation and breaking down forever chemicals using light-initiated degradation techniques.
I think we've all heard the term PFAS now, but give us a quick summary of why we should be a little bit worried about it.
So PFAS are everywhere, and they do range in different concentrations, and that determines how dangerous they are to us. But they are used in a range of household products, including toothpaste. We can also see them in firefighting foams, but Australia has now stopped using those, which is great. So this is definitely a hot topic of research at the moment, and it is heavily debated among scientists in this field. But having said that, from what we can see so far, is that there are real concerns about cancers, diabetes, obesity, lowering your immune response, but it can also result in mutations. And so we can see this in birth defects as well. So it's a real risk for a broad range of reasons. It's just the amount of PFAS that will result in that is what is contested.
You're working on how to break these down. They're already out there in the world. They're even, I think, in water sources, in our bodies as well. How are you trying to do that?
We're trying to carefully design these nanoparticles. And when we shine light on these nanoparticles, they can facilitate a chemical reaction, and we're trying to break the bonds. Those bonds in the PFAS pollutants are really strong, and that's what leads to their persistence. So if we can change these nanoparticles and alter some of their properties, we can try to break those really strong bonds in PFAS and hopefully solve this problem.
It sounds like a pretty handy and simple cocktail. I imagine there's some complexity in the nanoparticles though. So what are these nanoparticles? How do they work?
Some of the nanoparticles that I'm using at the moment is zinc sulfide. So we've got zinc and sulfur, our two elements in equal ratios. And I make these through a different range of synthetic techniques. And then we can shine UV light actually on these. And that can help break down the PFAS. And we've seen really promising results with these so far. And we can actually break down PFAS fully within a few hours.
So the idea is you're going to use these nanoparticles activated with UV light, and you're going to do this in water treatment plants. We're not talking about putting this into people's bodies or out into the environment as a potential secondary pollutant, correct?
Yeah, these technologies will be isolated to a continuous flow reactor, and so there certainly won't be any risk of people being exposed to the nanoparticles that I'm making.
And what does that continuous flow reactor look like? Is that like a film of the fresh water being pumped into systems in water treatment plants?
Yeah, so I have a film of my nanoparticles and zinc sulfide in this case, and we can flow contaminated water across that film, and we have a window above that film. And so we can shine light from top down, and we flow our PFAS or contaminated water across it. And then in that duration, as it's passing across the film and interacting with those nanoparticles, we're going to be breaking those bonds and breaking down PFAS and then hopefully clean water on the back end. The great thing about zinc sulfide is that it's relatively non-toxic and it's made from earth-abundant elements. So from a cost perspective as well, it's really promising. Having said that, this technology will probably be used independently and potentially in conjunction with already existing water treatment plants. And so we can degrade PFAS that's more concentrated and try to solve the problem that way.
I imagine you're still kind of in the early stages of testing this technology, optimizing how it can work. But do we know how resilient these films are going to be yet?
So there's still definitely some optimization that needs to happen. But from what we can see so far, we see a really good longevity of these films and the photocatalysts themselves. So they can remain active for a long period of time and continue to break those carbon to fluorine bonds present in PFAS.
All right, Mabel, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Alongside PhD students, Australian researchers spoke this year on topics ranging from biomanufacturing to better bushfire monitoring, including Karen O'Connor, who works for the Earth Fire Alliance, a project aiming to help firefighters globally with better satellite imaging.
It's definitely a global issue now. Australia's had a wildfire issue for a long time, and we've become accustomed to it. We are a country of fire. But now countries that have never had fire problems are starting to have them. And from what we hear, that is only anticipated to grow. The United Nations has estimated that by 2050, wildfires will have increased by 30%. We definitely think it's associated with climate impacts for sure. We're seeing increasing wildfire with changing temperatures. And unfortunately, this is a vicious cycle because wildfires are releasing their own emissions and contributing to the problem as well.
We've seen some horrifying wildfires in Australia recently. What do we know are the weaknesses of our current surveillance of fires and predictive abilities of fires at the moment?
I think it's the scale. Trying to find a needle in a haystack is the biggest issue. And right now, tools that we have available in most countries, not just Australia, are tools that were built for other things. So the satellite-based systems that are currently used to monitor for fire provides a lot of them, but those satellites weren't built to look for fire. They were built for other things, and they happened to be able to see fire. And so that means the resolution and the revisit of those systems is not up to par. Satellite data, for example, the systems that are in place at the moment are up to half a kilometer to a kilometer in pixel size, which means they can only see a fire after it's a certain size. And then some of them only come over every few days. So really the satellite information that is being received by fire agencies right now is extremely patchy and is not necessarily used as the main source of intelligence. For a lot of the fire agencies, they use aircraft to monitor fires. And actually over 90% of wildfires in Australia are detected by someone actually seeing it and calling 000. So what we're trying to do with Earth Fire Alliance is have an intelligence source that every fire agency in the world can have eyes on every fire in their region every 20 minutes. So it's a good baseline piece of information where the fire agencies no longer have to go looking for fire. They know where that fire is and they can make decisions about it.
So tell me about Earth Fire Alliance. Why was this organization established and what are the goals?
Earth Fire Alliance is a nonprofit organization, a global nonprofit, and it was stood up by a joint team of Australian and US leaders, engineers. We're a group that understands the science problem, understands the space industry, and understands what we need to do to make some change. And the reason we stood up the Earth Fire Alliance was to fill the gap in information for fire monitoring. With the developments in space industry in the last 10 to 20 years, we now have an opportunity that we wouldn't have had before, where space is affordable enough to create a global system that would be specific for fire. So what we're intending to do, and we have already launched our first protoflight satellite, we're intending to launch a full constellation of 50 plus satellites that will be specifically designed for fire. And the specs of that constellation was actually designed by Australian and US fire agencies. So the first thing we did was we talked to the experts that would be using that system, how often they would need to see an image, and what other information that would be helpful to them from a system like that. And that's where we started. And now, 3 or 4 years after those initial conversations, we're already starting to launch those satellites.
There are stacks of satellites up there already. What does this constellation of 50 satellites offer that the other ones up there don't already give you?
Well, because it has been designed by the fire community for the fire community, it is information that is quite specific to looking for and monitoring fires. So the system is really a new technology that's designed to see thermal imagery at a resolution of 50 meters on average. What that means is with the analytics that we have today, we can see a fire as small as 5 by 5 meters. That's a very early stage fire. Right now with the systems that are in place up in space, a fire has to be 2 or 3 or 4 acres before it can be seen by a satellite. So it gives us the ability to provide situational awareness to agencies from very early start of a fire. And then the revisit, needing 50 satellites, means that we have a revisit of 20 minutes on average. So that means every 20 minutes, every agency in the world can get an update on where all the fires are in their region, how far they've spread, and in what direction. And that gives a huge amount of information. And because this system is global, it means every fire agency in the world gets that information all the time. We are a nonprofit, and I think that makes us quite different to a lot of the efforts going on around the world. Currently, we are fully philanthropically supported. We have some amazing funders who see the value in a system like this with relation to climate and wildfire and community support, and they're willing to put money into this in the early stages. And I have come from philanthropy, so I understand how philanthropies work. They're very good at de-risking a space. They will come in with early funding if they see that there's value in it. And that's the stage that we're at right now. We are going to launch 3 live satellites with that support from philanthropic funders. And then the intention is to have bigger multi-government conversations to keep that system sustained and to grow it out. And we already have some interest from some governments. But it is always our intention to make sure that every fire agency has access to that data and that they don't have to personally put their hand in their pocket to pay for it.
Give me a sense of the timelines from here to having this network operational and this data shared for governments to use.
Earth Fire Alliance was founded in 2024. It was based on a program that has been running for 2 to 3 years before that. So we have done our homework. Our intention is to have the first 3 live satellites up, and they will provide a 12-hour revisit of information to key early adopters, including fire agencies in 5 states and territories across Australia who have signed up to be early adopters for our program. In being an early adopter, they are going to also help us to streamline getting the data through to operational decision-making. So their insights and their expertise will help us to then roll it out internationally. And then the intention after that initial operational capability, which will be philanthropically funded, is then to build out the 50-plus satellite constellation by 2030. We already have a path to do that, and we are already in early conversations with governments to get initial support towards that. But we want everyone to have that data by 2030.
And why is it important to be here at a summit like Falling Walls to talk about this work and to talk with others in the field as well?
It's such a valuable opportunity to get to talk with other scientists and be part of the conversation about how we all work together and collaborate to have impact. And I think Earth Fire Alliance is an example of something that's really trying to do that. I'm looking forward to being on one of the panels to really have a conversation about how data can really make change for wildfire. And it's great to have wildfire be a topic at this summit because it's such a pertinent topic and it's something that affects everyone.
A big part of the Falling Walls Science Summit is presenting research or innovations that have led to real-world impacts or have the potential to make significant change in our lives. And many in the tech and health space present the early stages of their work to potential investors, often in Shark Tank-style pitching rounds.
My name is Stefan Maisy. I am the CEO and founder of Derma Health.
What are you here to talk about at Falling Walls?
I guess initially we're talking about our technology, which is a new way to diagnose skin cancer. But we're hoping to actually talk about the bigger issue, which is how our solution can actually transform healthcare systems with effective triage of skin cancer.
It's a big claim. So many of us in Australia especially understand the joy of a biopsy. We've all had moles or other things chopped out of us at one point or another, or seen them chopped out of our friends and family. This process often involves a scalpel taking a big chunk of skin. Why are the current system of biopsies an issue? Are there any problems with how we're doing biopsies right now?
I think there are a lot of problems. First and foremost, I compare it to like going to the dentist. So you have a cavity, you know you have a sore tooth, you are going to put that off because you know pain is going to be involved. I think that initial mindset is already fundamentally a problem because people are delaying something and inevitable. The next step is getting that biopsy. It is a practitioner-only skill set that only doctors can do. For context, there are about 1 million avoidable biopsies that were performed last year just in Australia that can only be done by doctors. The problem there is that general practitioners aren't necessarily trained to perform biopsies. So often what they will do is refer them to dermatologists. And that in itself has about 3 to 4 month wait time. And so constantly with each of these pathways, we're delaying diagnosis. Now, where the issue goes even further is that going to histopathology, we have skill shortages over there. And that takes a lot of time to dissect, to actually process that actual sample. And even then, it's actually subjective. It's all based on visual interpretation. So every step of the way, somebody is looking at a lesion and they think it is cancer. And in order to prove it's not cancer, they have to take a biopsy. That's a very broken system. Even the analytical stage, they have to physically look at the biopsy tissue and figure out if it's cancer.
So tell me about the microsampling technology that you've got then. What are we talking about here?
Our solution is designed to replace a doctor-led approach with nurses in allied health that can perform a microsampling alternative and free up doctors' resources to address other more pressing health concerns. So what we've developed is a microsampling tool that's comprised of uniquely barbed structures. So I guess it just looks like needles, like nothing fancy. But under a microscope, we've actually created these new structures that when they go into the skin, they actually, upon removal, collect tissue. It is a millimeter long. We have an array of about 35 to 45 needles. The whole device is about 3 millimeters in diameter. You apply it on your skin for about 10 seconds and it feels like a bit of pressure. There's no pain, there's no bleeding, there's no downtime. And that whole procedure is over literally within 30 seconds. That is enough for us to figure out if that lesion is cancerous.
And that's enough for us to do the same level of diagnostic ability then? Or is it a reduced quality of diagnostic ability?
We're actually doing a different diagnostic altogether. So the current approach is histopathology. You need a large sample to slice up to put under a microscope effectively, gets imaged and somebody looks at it. Our diagnostic approach uses a genetic test. Now genetics is digital, it is objective, and it's highly sensitive. So you actually need a few cells as opposed to a giant piece of tissue. And what we're actually measuring with our device is whether or not that lesion is cancer. So it's a yes or no, so it's binary. And we can do that without requiring any visual assessment.
Do we know how effective it is?
Yes. We've been very fortunate. So we've finished our first in-human clinical trials. We're just about to start our pilot phase. But in our first in-human trials, we detected skin cancer with 99% sensitivity. And the most important one is actually specificity. And this is where right now 60% are benign. We were at 96% in ruling out non-cancerous lesions. So our approach currently is better than the current workflow, and it also is better than all competing triage technologies.
Besides Australian speakers like Stefan Maisy from Derma Health, there's also a smattering of Kiwis in the crowd at this summit in Berlin.
My name is Ankit Parikh, and I'm a research and development engineer in Auckland, and at the same time, I'm a PhD student at Auckland University of Technology.
Well, congratulations on winning the New Zealand Falling Walls competition. What is your topic of research then?
I'm trying to address a problem known as chronic pain, which affects around 1 in 5 adults in the Western world. And it's that number is likely higher in lower income countries. And the means of treatments that we have right now, surgeries and medications especially opioids, do more harm than good in a lot of people. So we need drug-free, non-surgical options, and that's what I'm trying to create.
So what is your intervention then? If it's drug-free, what are you doing?
My intervention involves non-invasively stimulating the vagus nerve through its branch in the ear.
In the ear, did you say?
In the ear, yes. So there are nerve endings from the vagus nerve, the outer ear, and they can be stimulated using electrical current. And there are patterns of electrical current and stimulation that will activate certain brainstem regions, which will help the brain modulate pain through various internal mechanisms. Also, if that stimulation is timed with your exhalation respiration cycle, it can be even more effective. But so far, the research has been limited to laboratories, mostly in the United States, because portable equipment didn't exist. So I took on that challenge to build a portable kit that could be used in home-based clinical trials.
So I think to understand how electrical stimulation of your ear can help with chronic pain management, we need to take a few steps back here. Sure. So first of all, what do we know about chronic pain and how we can treat it already?
Acute pain is a means of our survival. And once the injury has healed, the pain should subside. Acute pain becomes chronic due to factors like overactive pain processing in the brain. I'm really simplifying this. Immune system dysregulation also plays a part in this. And overactive body stress response, which is commonly known as the flight and fight response. So when these mechanisms are out of balance, the brain's not able to modulate pain as well as it could. With vagus nerve stimulation, research shows that these mechanisms can be regulated, allowing the brain to modulate pain better by releasing endogenous opioids, by activating these inhibitory pathways which allow suppressing more pain signals going to the brain. That's what I'm trying to do.
So chronic pain is a misfiring of some of our nervous system. And the idea is that through this electrical stimulation of the vagus nerve, through where it connects, you know, its outer ends to your ear, you can maybe reset some of that misfiring.
The misfiring, there is a medical term for that, maladaptive neuroplasticity. So neuroplasticity is how we learn things. A downside of it is we learn things that are not needed for us also. So when all these pain signals are misfiring or overfiring, the brain dedicates an area to dealing with that and allows people to learn to be in more pain. And that's what we're trying to do. By activating these internal mechanisms, we want to weaken that maladaptive neuroplastic loop so that eventually it is weak enough such that pain's in the background and you can get back to the life that you had before pain.
And so what does this treatment look and feel like?
The treatment that I've developed requires wearing a simple respiration strap that measures changes in your respiratory state, so knows when the exhalation started. We are also curious to know if there's changes in heart rate variability. So we've got a fingertip pulse sensor so that you wear the sensors, you have a mobile app. And I did a study where participants took this kit home. So every day they would log in and the mobile app would guide them through setting up the sensors. And then there's a custom earbud that they wear. And there's a stimulator which also connects wirelessly to the app. And then they set the intensity that feels as if it's strong but not uncomfortable. So they know that the nerve endings are sensing these short electrical pulses.
So that kind of gently zaps your ear, right?
The wire from the stimulator, but the stimulator is wireless. It's the size of a mobile phone. And then the app guides them through a relaxing 20-minute session where they're just supposed to relax. And as they breathe in and out, the system detects exhalation and just at the right time imparts the stimulation. And once they're done with 20 minutes, they put the things back and they're done for the day. And they continue to do this over the next few days.
And it sounds very simple, maybe a bit uncomfortable to get zapped on the ear like this while you're breathing gently, but how effective is this at treating chronic pain? Does it actually work?
That is the golden question we would like to answer. So we've started at a pilot stage where we've proven that it's feasible to use this. And we selected a really tricky population with rheumatoid arthritis who have limited dexterity in their hands, and they could use this by taking it home. The next stage would be to compare this to some control group to see how effective it is. We know research supports this. There's also invasive implantable vagus nerve stimulation that's FDA approved for treatment-resistant epilepsy and treatment-resistant depression. Chronic pain is a new frontier. We know that the mechanisms are shared between inflammation and pain modulation. And in the lab, this has been proven. So now it's time to take it from bench side to bedside. That's what we're trying to do.
And for anyone out there who's got chronic pain and is excited about this as a therapy solution for their lives, how far away are we from seeing something like this that people can actually use or try themselves at home?
5 to 7 years is possible because being non-invasive, there aren't many complications related to safety. And it is well documented in terms of side effects. You feel a bit of redness, a bit of tingling in your ear, and that disappears. Also, you get used to the intensity of stimulation, so it may feel a bit more painful to begin with, but as the session progresses, towards the end, people actually increase the intensity because they can't feel it as much as they did at the start. So it's safe and it's usable, and I think 5 to 7 years is a good timeline. There are a lot of wellness devices out there. We've taken a clinical path because we want to prove that there is efficacy, hence this can be made accessible.
I imagine you'd have a bit of a warning then for some of these devices that are being sold without any sort of clinical backbone to them as well. So do you have anything you'd like to share for consumers who are eager to get some treatment, some different solutions for their chronic pain and are seeing things like this advertised online? What recommendations would you give them?
I would recommend users to see, most of them should have a science section, and in that they should have clinical studies that have been published to show that the system's safe and feasible, and there's potentially an application for the specific condition that they're trying to treat. You could use this. There are some devices that are already out there. They do not deliver stimulation in time with exhalation. And that's something you could discuss with your GP.
And just finally, I'm just curious about what it's like for you coming from winning, you know, Falling Walls in New Zealand, and then coming here to Berlin to Falling Walls to share your research with the wider global research community on the global stage.
I am stoked. And I am grateful. It is a very mentally stimulating environment. There's some really, really smart people here. So yeah, I'm just grateful. This is incredible. And I look forward to listening to all the ideas that are being presented.
Thank you very much, Ankit. Really appreciate it. And enjoy your time here at Falling Walls.
Thank you, Carl.
Other more established research projects also compete at the summit to be named as the most exciting breakthroughs of the year across a range of fields judged by a global committee.
My name is Professor Michael Schütz. I'm an orthopedic surgeon and I'm chair of trauma at QUT. I did my training in Berlin and I know, of course, the organizers from the Falling Walls quite well. But since now 2 years, I'm the chair for the jury picking the breakthrough for life science of it each year, which is quite a challenging task. So I'm the global jury chair for life science.
For someone who's never been to Falling Walls, what does it mean to be on the jury? What does it mean to pick the winner of the life sciences division?
We had about 130 applications from very esteemed researchers or very advanced research groups, and we're looking for the impact which the research may have, the methods they're using. Now, all of them have a strong background, can't understand everything, and so we have to bring all our knowledge together. And we have senior editors from Nature who are also helping us in analyzing the value of the research and of the potential breakthrough for society.
And this summit is all about breakthroughs. You know, this term Falling Walls is all about what is the next wall to fall, looking at science. And so what has impressed you and the jury in terms of life sciences this year?
This year we settled on a winner. We have 10 winners and one breakthrough. But the breakthrough is from Munich, director of the Max Planck Institute, Milena Schuh. She utilized Varian imaging of the evolution of life in a uterus and to understand much better the evolution on what can come out of it for intervention. Then you have areas which are very early on detecting some cell mechanism in the human beings, which are still very far away from translation. Even they have a high research impact, but we have to consider, will it ever make it through to changing healthcare at one stage? Yes. And other ones, they were, of course, linking large databases together to understand our brain working and our consequences of traumatic brain injuries. So it's really, you can look from every angle, from every disease. There's one group certainly working on it, is rare diseases. We had multiple applications working on solutions for brain tumors. We had actually one applicant last year who won it. You know, he was a clinician who reduced the death rate. He already showed the impact.
The focus of Falling Walls is to look for these innovations in science research and technology that will change our societies and our lives. And this means there's follow through. It's not just an interesting idea or some research that's been published. It's looking for things that have the legs to really impact our lives and our world. I'd be curious to get your reflections on whether we in Australia are supporting projects in research and science to go that far.
I think this is basically the holy grail when you really want to make translation. And many of the meetings, I attended few of them, countries, we have a strong Italian presence here, the French, UK, US, Australia is present, Japan, and we're all looking, how can we do it best? Obviously, and we all know, we are looking very strongly to the US and particular, you know, recent development with AI or other tools. And there's a lot of entrepreneurial risk-taking. And we don't hear about the ones who failed, but we hear about the ones, and they did very well, obviously, who were successful. But what I've seen in those discussions, what I've learned also while I'm chairing a MedTech Incubator Board in Switzerland, it is the entrepreneurial aspect. And sometimes the researchers may not have it themselves, but you have to partner with someone who has this entrepreneurial, this willing not to fail. We always say, yes, you can fail. But nevertheless, this is not how winners are made. Winners are made, they don't want to fail. And they always find something else to push yourself to the finish line. And so coming back to your question, I think Australia has a very esteemed and you know, we have Nobel Prize winners this year again. And yes, we have also success stories. But I think for the comparison of research that we are doing, we probably should translate more for the society. And I feel even we have funding streams, but later on you have to develop business cases that investment venture capitals are coming in. And this is where Australia is lacking, but not just Australia, also Europe is lacking this compared to US. So we have to understand the business development that investors, even international investors, become attractive to certain projects. And while obviously the Australian market is small, you have to develop then your business case for the American, the European, the Asian market as well, that it becomes attractive. And I think this is for me the challenge. And also when you're a little bit remote in Australia, we have to be more risk-taking, entrepreneurial, partnering with other countries in the world also together with other groups to make the business case right.
One of the breakthroughs this year in art and science went to Berlin-based Italian artist Marco Barotti. His recent underwater sonic coral resilience installations are inspired by work by British researcher Timothy Lamont, who recorded the sounds of healthy and unhealthy coral reefs in the Great Barrier Reef.
My name is Marco Barotti. I'm a multimedia artist based in Berlin, and I work at the intersection of art, science, and technology.
Tell me a little bit about some of your most recent work with coral.
The most recent is Coral Sonic Resilience. Let's say it's an art and science collaboration that investigates how the soundscapes of healthy coral reefs can support the recovery of damaged ones.
I've had a little look at some of the pictures and videos online, and you're speaking here at Falling Walls. We're outside the venue. We can hear the sounds of ambulances and crows here. And sound is really important to understand the health of any environment and to understand what exists in any environment. My understanding is that with the coral reefs work that you're doing, you're basically embedding these sonic devices. They play the sounds of what a healthy reef sounds like when you have all of the full ecosystem there that is managing a healthy reef. And that sort of gives a cue to some of these reef-building species, these important keystone species, to come back to damaged reefs.
Yes, sounds of fish and coral larvae, they use sound to navigate and to locate suitable habitats to settle and grow. So if a reef is alive with sound, it's most likely to stay alive. But then when reefs degrade, they grow silent. Our effort is basically to bring, in this collaboration of art and science, sculptures, sonic sculptures, let's say, that are made of ceramic and calcium carbonate. Actually, 23% of calcium carbonate. This comes from a very deep research, a lot of trial and error with it. So when we install the sculptures underwater, we create a new habitat for the marine ecosystems. So when we call back the fishes and other marine organisms with the soundscapes, the idea is that you don't offer them like a desolated area, but you offer them an infrastructure to grow with and to build a new life in. So the sculptures are made in a way that fishes can enter and exit from different parts of it. And they're always installed in symbiosis with coral restoration project, so that there is already an artificial reef taking place. And now the next challenge is to bring this new experimental design again in the Maldives in 2026, where we will experiment with one sculpture with sound and one sculpture without sound set at 50 meters apart for direct data comparison.
And there's some Australian connections to this work as well.
The first research was done in Australia. So Timothy did his research for over 40 days in the Great Barrier Reef. And this is where everything started. And now the work that I'm doing more for the human community, so above water, which is actually shown here at the Berlin Science Week, it will be shown at the Science Gallery in Melbourne in June 2026. And it will go on tour mainly hand by hand, always with research. I don't know about Australia, but I will go to Jamaica with TBA 21, which is ocean space in Venice. And then the show will be at the Venice Biennale of Architecture in 2027 and in Bahrain as well. This was organized by the Berlin Science Week. So non-human artwork and the human artwork, they go hand by hand, you know, with art and science to bring, in one end, let's say, to try to repair the ecosystem underwater, and on the other hand, to bring the message to the human community about the coral situation globally.
So we're going to play just a little bit of the sound of a healthy reef now. And we're going to play the sound of a less healthy reef. Could you describe those two sounds?
Well, it's very obvious, no? Like in the one, the LT reef sound is very rich. There is a lot of different acoustic signature from different species that you hear that they are doing their life. It's like a city. There is a guy screaming around. There is a guy with a bicycle. There is someone else driving a car around. So if you see coral reefs as a way of an habitat, of a living habitat, every individual has its role and has its moment. And this comes with sound always, so the acoustic part of it. And in the not healthy coral reef, you basically hear more the silence of it. So if you walk around in a Berlin forest, for example, which is always very weird because there is no sound, there is almost no birds. So it gives you a sort of sadness inside. So it's very different. The audience as well judge for it, no?
This feels in some ways like a trick. You've got this reef that is degraded and it's in the process of being rehabilitated by scientists, and you're playing the sounds of a healthy reef there to try and encourage more of these fish and other creatures back. Do you ever worry about the ethics of this? You know, whether you're kind of tricking these creatures to come back to a reef that isn't actually the reality that the sounds might have made them believe it was.
But this is exactly why we do it. It's symbiosis and collaboration always with coral restoration project, so that the more than human community that we invite back into an ecosystem, they don't find just death, actually, but they find something that is rebuilding. Place where they can rebuild a new life, basically.
What sort of success have you seen? I know it's very early days with this project, and there's a lot more work to be done in terms of the science here to check the effectiveness of this. But I'm curious whether you are starting to see fish, other reef-building species coming back into these places where you're playing these sounds underwater.
Now, I can tell you from my individual experience, because in the Maldives I stayed for 2 months, so every morning my daily task was swimming down and check what's going on. Yeah, tough job, exactly, like 6 o'clock, go and have a swim and check how the ecosystem is growing, if it's growing. So it felt very good to be there. And it felt like the fishes were happy. When it comes to data, so the data is not ready yet. And hopefully after the second expedition, which will end probably July or August 2026, we will publish a paper by the end of the year with the results.
What do these underwater sonic sculptures look like for someone who's never seen them?
They are based on 3D scans of bleached corals. And the structure and the texture is based on 3D scan of bleached corals. And the design is thought to invite the marine life to shelter, to settle and grow. They look like a totem. So it's like a totem sculpture underwater that has the texture of a brain coral.
It's been very funny to me during this interview. You've had a chorus of crows behind you, seemingly celebrating you creating artworks for nature. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk here just outside the Falling Walls venue on the streets of Berlin. It's been a pleasure, Marco.
Thank Grazie mille. Much. Bye-bye. Ciao. Grazie.
And with a strong focus on more than just straight science projects, the festival celebrates a range of less traditional research contributions, including a winner and the founder of the Ig Nobel Prizes.
I'm Mark Abrams. I am the editor of a magazine called The Annals of Improbable Research. I also founded the Ig Nobel Prizes.
For those who don't know, just describe those two different things for us.
I really like things that surprise me in a way that's going to stick with me. That's what it's about. The Ig Nobel Prize, first one was in 1991. We give out 10 prizes a year. They are for things that make people laugh and then think. That's the only criterion. The moment they hear about this, they're going to start laughing, and then it's going to stick in their head. So for next week, the only thing they want to do is tell their friends. The magazine reports on research, some of it new, some of it very old. This is all real stuff that seems at first glance probably kind of crazy because it's way outside most people's experience. The question somebody is looking at is so far outside people's experience that it just seems nuts. Why would someone do this? And as you start reading it, you may decide, yes, it's nuts, but you may also decide the opposite, which is that, you know, I never really thought about this. And now that I think about it, it's still funny, but damn, I want to know.
Now, before we come to a winner of the Ig Nobel in a moment. So the Annals of Improbable Research, if they were to open it for the first time, what sort of articles would they see in there? Give us a snapshot of the kinds of things they might find.
Where to start? So we've had topics on physics and chemistry and things like that, but also we had a special issue on feathers, a special issue on children, a special issue on bad smells, a special issue on pizza and popcorn. Each of these things, there has been more research done by careful scientists on these topics and many, many more than you might believe. Most of it, like most scientific research, was written up and published in a science journal, and maybe 6 people saw it, and that was the end of it. But either we found it or somebody ran across it and they sent it to us.
Now, Kees, I'll get you to introduce yourself.
My name is Kees Mulliker. I'm former director of the Natural History Museum in Rotterdam. And I was awarded the Ig Nobel Prize in the field of biology in the year 2003.
What did you get the award for?
I'm the discoverer of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck.
What a claim. Tell us more.
It was a chance observation when I worked at the museum as a curator of birds, and the museum had just got a new wing. It was made entirely out of glass, and well, birds have a problem with glass. They tend to fly into the glass, they get killed, and especially our building was a real bird killer, so it meant a lot of work for me because we decided to get all the birds inside in the collection. And in those years, we talk about the early 1990s, I developed the absolute ear for the sounds birds make when they crash into windows. So if I heard like this, that would be a robin, this would be like a gull. But on June 5th, 1995, I heard this tremendous loud bang against the window of my office. And I wanted to know what bird got killed this time. So I looked out of the window and I saw a mallard duck laying flat on his belly, dead. But next to the dead duck was a live duck. And then instantly, the live duck mounted the dead duck and started to copulate. So I said, well, listen, I'm a biologist. I know birds. I know bird behavior. But this was not in the books I studied. I mean, one is dead, one is alive. There's copulation. That's necrophilia. And indeed, both were of the male sex, so homosexual necrophilia. So I was, well, confused because this must be new. It can be new to science. So I took a notebook, took my camera, made pictures. Luckily, I had a film in my camera and I made notes. I could do this for 75 minutes. The bird did not stop. After 75 minutes, I got hungry. I wanted to go home. So I went out, collected the duck for the collection. And basically, I kept the notes to myself for about 6 years. Every now and then, I told about this, what I saw at birthday parties or in the pub. But I could not share it with my peers. I could not publish it. I had no background information. I mean, this was before the internet, so you had to go to libraries and look for this subject, which is not in the index of any book. But after 6 years, it was in 2001, I came across a book published by a Canadian biologist. It's called Biological Exuberance, and it's 800 pages filled with all kinds of behavior that's not in the biology books. And there was a chapter on the mallard duck, and there was homosexuality in it.
Necrophilia as well?
There was a sign that I was not alone, so I came out of the closet with my story. I published the first case of homosexual necrophilia in the mallard duck, and it was published in a zoology journal. But then I got this message from Mark from Cambridge, Massachusetts, telling me that I'd won a prize. I didn't even know about this prize, but I never won a prize. So I said, yes, please. So I went to Harvard University to collect the prize. And ever since, now I'm the duck guy.
Well, congratulations. As I said, what a claim to fame. I think it's fantastic. This was published as a case report. Mm-hmm. Just curious whether you've seen any further examples of this since that first incident.
Yeah, especially after I won the Ig Nobel Prize, there was a lot of press coverage. And people started to send me their observations. They found old books, newspaper clippings, observations, pictures. And I've compiled what I call the necrophilia files. And I have like 89 species of vertebrate animals, say mammals, frogs, birds, that are engaged in similar behavior. Well, I think it changed a lot of things for the general public, because homosexual behavior in humans is in many cultures, many countries, regarded as an illness. It should be cured. And it's persisting till today. When you talk about this subject and you talk about a duck, suddenly people start to listen. They open their eyes and they open their ears and say, hey, so this is happening in nature too. So it helps people to open their minds for diversity, for sexual behavior. It had an impact.
And beyond the research that opens our minds, Professor Brian Schmidt says joining festivals like the Falling Walls Summit is also an opportunity for researchers to connect, to compare what's working in different countries' approaches to science or R&D, and to reflect on the gaps in our policies.
Australia has a great research community. What it has is a very passive government response to why is research important. And I don't think our government has really figured it out yet. But when it comes to as a priority, the reality is they always choose other things, and they have systematically defunded research over the last 15 or 20 years. And the way the system has managed to remain healthy is we have brought in more and more international students who have made up the gap. But we've kind of reached an inflection point where we're not going to get away with that anymore. We live in a very unsettled time, and research is far more important to the future trajectory of the country than I think people think about. So it does concern me. Our prosperity is not guaranteed in the future. We could kind of fizzle away and we all end up kind of not having as good a lives as we're used to. So I think our research needs to be seen as a strategic priority. And it's much more complicated than just making widgets out of ideas. It is a whole ecosystem that allows us to take knowledge and transfer it to all sorts of things, including companies, but also to a better health system, happier, healthier lives, an ecosystem that still has koalas that are healthy and everything in between.
One of the big focuses of Falling Walls is translational research, research that really will impact people's lives and societies if it isn't already. How do you think Australia's doing on that front?
What I like about Falling Walls is it actually has the foundational work and the translation sitting side by side in a healthy way. It's not one or the other. It is both. That's a healthy ecosystem. So Australia is actually doing better and better at translating ideas, but it's from a pretty low base. The ecosystem in Australia is still very shallow. And the ecosystem actually needs a lot of private sector input. We seem to keep on thinking it's somehow the university's fault. Well, I'm telling you, in the United States, at least, it's the private sector that pulls. It's not the universities that push. Private sector has the scale, the money, the agility to really make things happen. And that's some of the things that I think we're doing better. So one of the things that I think has been very effective recently in Australia is the National Reconstruction Fund. Doesn't sound like an innovation tool, but it is. It is a way of funding ideas and getting them up to scale quickly because Australians tend not to like to take risk. Life's good. Why take risk? And so you'll have these brilliant ideas and they just kind of languish because, oh, I don't know, I don't want to risk any money. So the government getting in there and making sense of what is really a market failure, where we just don't have enough risky capital, is an important ingredient. It's not everything. We need to have people who know how to scale up companies. We need to make sure the regulatory burden of starting a company is much faster. So there's a whole bunch of things we need to do. But I would say the ecosystem is actually getting better. But I really want to make it clear, it's actually a private sector thing that really drives it. Government has to jumpstart it. Universities need to be supportive, get out of the way and get things going. But it's the ecosystem that we have to grow. And we are growing it.
A lot of the ethos of the programming here is not just to talk about the raw research, the raw technology. It's also to talk about the communication of this work, the art that is profiling interesting science in new ways. And I think there is a real appreciation here in German society for science.
The Germans understand that science is part of culture. And, you know, they spend a lot of effort here on culture. There's 3 opera houses in Berlin. There are more opera houses, I think, in Berlin than there are in Australia. You know, it is a place that thinks about culture at a very foundational way. So I really appreciate the ability to bring science and culture together like we're doing. Now, we try to do this in Australia. We have Science Week. And, you know, there's a program that has been brought in from the U.S. that I've participated up in Queensland that I think try to do this.
The World Festival.
Yeah, that's right. So there are some attempts in Australia, but we don't quite seem to pull it off with the panache and the excitement and the energy that we see here. You know, maybe South by Southwest in Sydney is another bit. So maybe we do it in our own different ways. But there's a genuine energy and excitement about how it happens here. Science is part of culture. Let me reflect that Australia doesn't invest much in culture anymore. Whatever reason, it's gone off the radar of both philanthropy and governments is something it funds. And this is really funded here in Germany, I think, more from a cultural perspective, like the opera houses. So I actually would love to see Australia invest a tiny amount of money in cultural activities that support music, the arts, and science like they do here in a place like Berlin, because I think it would make the place a happier, more interesting place. And I can tell you, it's not very expensive relative to everything else we do, and it is part of something I've seen fade away in Australia in the 30-some years that I've lived there that kind of saddens me a little bit.
Professor Brian Schmidt, former Vice Chancellor of the Australian National University and Nobel Prize winner, thank you so much for taking the time to talk and enjoy your time here at Falling Walls in Berlin.
Thank you so much.
Carl Smith with Nobel laureate Brian Schmidt. And we'll hear more from Carl later in the year. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.